A lot of people just ride back and forth on it, looking at the sights. When Hiro first saw this place 10 years ago, the monorail hadn't been written yet. He and his buddies had to write car and motorcycle software in order to get around. They would take their software out and race it in the black desert of the electronic night. Four. YT has been privileged to watch many a young Clint plant his sweet face in an empty burbclave pool during an unauthorized night run, but always on a skateboard, never, ever in a car. The landscape of the suburban night has much weird beauty if you just look. Back on the paddle again. It rolls across the yard on a set of Radic-KS Mark IV smart wheels. She upgraded to said magical sprockets after the following ad appeared in Thrasher magazine. Chiseled spam is what you will see in the mirror if you surf on a weak plank with dumb fixed wheels and interface with a muffler, retread, snow turd, roadkill, drive shaft, railroad tie, or unconscious pedestrian. If you think this is unlikely, you've been surfing too many ghost malls. All of these obstacles and more were recently observed on a 1 mile stretch of the New Jersey Turnpike. Any surfer who tried to groove that vard on a stock plank would have been sneezing brains. Don't listen to so-called purists who claim any obstacle can be jumped. Professional couriers know, if you have pooned a vehicle moving fast enough for fun and profit, your reaction time is cut to tenths of a second, even less if you are way spooled. Buy a set of Radic-KS Mark II smart wheels. It's cheaper than a total face retread and a lot more fun. Smart wheels use sonar, laser range finding, and millimeter wave radar to identify mufflers and other debris before you even get honed about them. Don't get miticized. Upgrade today. These were words of wisdom. YT bought the wheels. Each one consists of a hub with many stout spokes. Each spoke telescopes in 5 sections. On the end is a squat foot, rubber tread on the bottom, swiveling on a ball joint. As the wheels roll, the feet plant themselves one at a time, almost glomming into one continuous tire. If you surf over a bump, the spokes retract to pass over it. If you surf over a chuck hole, the roboprongs plumb its asphalty depths. Either way, the shock is thereby absorbed. No thuds, smacks, vibrations, or clunks will make their way into the plank or the converse high tops with which you tread it. The ad was right. You cannot be a professional road surfer without smart wheels. Prompt delivery of the pizza will be a trivial matter. She glides from the dewy turf over the lip of the driveway without a bump, picks up speed on the crete, surfs down its slope into the street. A twitch of the butt reorients the plank. Now she is cruising down Homedale Mews looking for a victim. A black car, alive with nasty lights, winds past her the other way, closing in on the hapless hero protagonist. Her Radic-KS night vision goggles darken strategically to cut the noxious glaring of same. Her pupils feel safe to remain wide open, scanning the road for signs of movement. The swimming pool was at the crest of this burbclave. It's downhill from here, but not downhill enough. Half a block away, on a side street, a bimbo box, a minivan, grinds its 4 pathetic cylinders into action. She sees it catter-corner from her present coordinates. The white backup lights flash instantly as the driver shifts into D by way of R and N. YT aims herself at the curb, hits it at a fast-running velocity. The spokes of the smart wheel see it coming and retract in the right way so that she glides from street to lawn without a hitch. Across the lawn, the feet leave a trail of hexagonal pad marks. A stray dog turd, red with meaty, undigestible food coloring, is embossed with the Radic-KS logo, a mirror image of which is printed on the tread of each spoke. The bimbo box is pulling away from the curb across the street. Squirrely scrubbing noises squirm from its sidewalls as they grind against the curb. We are in the burbs, where it is better to take 1,000 clicks off the lifespan of your good years by invariably grinding them up against curbs than to risk social ostracism and outbreaks of mass hysteria by parking several inches away, out in the middle of the street. That's okay, Mom. I can walk to the curb from here. A menace to traffic. A deadly obstacle to uncertain young bicyclists. YT has pressed the release button on her Poon's reel handle unit. allowing a meter of cord to unwind. She whips it up and around her head like a bolo on the Austral Range. She is about to lambada this trite conveyance. The head of the poon, salad bowl size, whistles as it orbits around. This is unnecessary, but sounds cool. Pooning a bimbo box takes more skill than a ped would ever imagine. Because of their very road unworthiness, their congenital lack of steel or other ferrous matter for the magna poon to bite down on. Now they have superconducting poons that stick to aluminum bodywork by inducing eddy currents in the actual flesh of the car, turning it into an unwilling electromagnet. But YT doesn't have one of these. They are the trademark of the hardcore Burbclave surfer, which, despite this evening's entertainment, she is not. Her poon will only stick to steel, iron, or slightly to nickel. The only steel in a bimbo box of this make is in the frame. She makes a low-slung approach. Her poon's orbital plane is nearly vertical. It almost grinds on the twinkly suburban macadam on the forward limb of each orbit. When she pounds the release button, it takes off from an altitude of about 1 centimeter, angling slightly upward, across the street, under the floor of the bimbo box, and sucks steel. It's a solid hit, as solid as you can get on this nebula of air, upholstery, paint, and marketing known as the family minivan. The reaction is instantaneous, quick-witted by Burb standards. This person wants YT gone. The van takes off like a hormone-pumped bull who has just been nailed in the ass by the barbed probe of a picador. It's not Mom at the wheel. It's young Studley, the teenaged boy, who, like every other boy in this Burbclave, has been taking intravenous shots of horse testosterone every afternoon in the high school locker room since he was 14 years old. Now he's bulky, stupid, thoroughly predictable. He steers erratically, artificially pumped muscles not fully under his control. The molded, leather-grained, maroon-colored steering wheel smells like his mother's hand lotion. This drives him into a rage. The bimbo box surges and slows, because he is pumping the gas pedal, because holding it to the floor doesn't seem to have any effect. He wants this car to be like his muscles, more power than he knows what to do with. Instead, it hampers him. As a compromise, he hits the button that says power. Another button that says economy pops out and goes dead, reminding him, like an educational demonstration, that the two are mutually exclusive. The van's tiny engine downshifts, which makes it feel more powerful. He holds his foot steady on the gas, and, making the run down Cottage Heights Road, the minivan's speed approaches 100 kilometers. Approaching the terminus of Cottage Heights Road, where it tees into Bellwood Valley Road, he espies a fire hydrant. TMAWH fire hydrants are numerous for safety and highly designed for property values, not the squat iron things imprinted with the name of some godforsaken Industrial Revolution foundry and furry from 100 variously flaked layers of cheap city paint. They are brass, robot-polished every Thursday morning, dignified pipes rising straight up from the perfect chemically-induced turf of the Burbclave lawns, flaring out to present potential firefighters with a menu of 3 possible hose connections. They were designed on a computer screen by the same aesthetes who designed the Dinah Victorian houses and the tasteful mailboxes and the immense marble street signs that sit at each intersection like headstones. Designed on a computer screen, but with an eye toward the elegance of things past and forgotten about. Fire hydrants that tasteful people are proud to have on their front lawns. Fire hydrants that the real estate people don't feel the need to airbrush out of pictures. This fucking courier is about to die, knotted around one of those fire hydrants. Studley, the testosterone boy, will see to it. It is a maneuver he has witnessed on television, which tells no lies. A trick he has practiced many times in his head. Building up maximum speed on Cottage Heights, he will yank the handbrake while swinging the wheel. The ass end of the minivan will snap around. The pesky courier will be cracked like a whip at the end of her unbreakable cable. Into the fire hydrant she will go. Studley, the teenager, will be victorious, free to cruise in triumph down Bellwood Valley and out into the greater world of adult men in cool cars, free to go return his overdue videotape, Raft Warriors 4, The Final Battle. YT does not know any of this for a fact, but she suspects it. None of this is real. It is her reconstruction of the psychological environment inside of that bimbo box. She sees the hydrant coming a mile away, sees Studley reaching down to rest one hand on the parking brake. It is all so obvious. She feels sorry for Studley and his ilk. She reels out, gives herself lots of slack. He whips the wheel, jerks the brake. The minivan goes sideways, overshooting its mark, and doesn't quite snap her around the way he wanted. She has to help it. As its ass is rotating around, she reels in hard, converting that gift of angular momentum into forward velocity, and ends up shooting right past the van, going well over a mile a minute. She is headed for a marble gravestone that says, Bellwood Valley Road. She leans away from it, leans into a vicious turn. Her spokes grip the pavement and push her away from that gravestone. She can touch the pavement with one hand. She is heeled over so hard. The spokes push her onto the desired street. Meanwhile, she has clicked off the electromagnetic force that held her poon to the van. The poon head comes loose, caroms off the pavement behind her, as it is automatically reeled in to reunite with the handle. She is headed straight for the exit of the Burbclave at fantastic speed. Behind her, an explosive crash sounds, resonating in her gut as the minivan slides sideways into the gravestone. She ducks under the security gate and plunges into traffic on Oahu. She cuts between two veering, blaring, and screeching BMWs. BMW drivers take evasive action at the drop of a hat, emulating the drivers in the BMW advertisements. This is how they convince themselves they didn't get ripped off. She drops into a fetal position to pass underneath a semi, headed for the Jersey barrier in the median strip like she's going to die. But Jersey barriers are easy for the smart wheels. That lower limb of the barrier has such a nice bank to it, like they designed it for road surfers. She rides halfway up the barrier, angles gently back down to the lane for a smooth landing, and she's in traffic. There's a car right there, and she doesn't even have to throw the poon, just reaches out and plants it right on the lid of the trunk. This driver's resigned to his fate, doesn't care, doesn't hassle her. He takes her as far as the entrance to the next Burbclave, which is a white columns. Very southern, traditional, one of the apartheid Burbclaves. Big ornate sign above the main gate. White people only. Non-Caucasians must be processed. She's got a White Columns visa. YT has a visa to everywhere. It's right there on her chest, a little barcode. A laser scans it as she careens toward the entrance and the immigration gate swings open for her. It's an ornate ironwork number, but harried White Columns residents don't have time to sit idling at the Burbclave entrance watching the gate slowly roll aside in Old South majestic turpitude. So it's mounted on some kind of electromagnetic railgun. She is gliding down the antebellum tree-lined lanes of White Columns, one microplantation after another, still coasting on the residual kinetic energy boost that originated in the fuel in Studley the teenager's gas tank. The world is full of power and energy, and a person can go far by just skimming off a tiny bit of it. The LEDs on the pizza box say 2932, and the guy who ordered it, Mr. Pudgley and his neighbors, the Pinkhearts and the Roundass Clan, are all gathered on the front lawn of their microplantation, prematurely celebrating. Like they had just bought the winning lottery ticket. From their front door, they have a clear view all the way down to Oahu Road, and they can see that nothing is on its way that looks like a Cosa Nostra delivery car. Oh, there is curiosity, sniffing interest at this courier with the big square thing under her arm. Maybe a portfolio, a new ad layout for some Caucasian supremacist marketing honcho in the next plat over, but the Pudgleys and the Pinkhearts and the round asses are all staring at her, slack-jawed. She has just enough residual energy to swing into their driveway. Her momentum carries her to the top. She stops next to Mr. Pudgley's Acura and Mrs. Pudgley's bimbo box and steps off her plank. The spokes, noting her departure, even themselves out, plant themselves on the top of the driveway, refuse to roll backward. A blinding light from the heaven shines down upon them. Her night visions keep her from being blinded, but the customers bend their knees and hunch their shoulders as though the light were heavy. The men hold their hairy forearms up against their brows, swivel their great tubular bodies to and fro, trying to find the source of the illumination, muttering clipped notations to each other, brief theories about its source, fully in control of the unknown phenomenon. The women coo and flutter. Because of the magical influence of the night visions, YT can still see the LEDs, 2954. And that's what it says when she drops the pizza on Mr. Pudgley's wingtips. The mystery light goes off. The others are still blinded, but YT sees into the night with her night visions, sees all the way into near infrared, and she sees the source of it, a double-bladed stealth helicopter 30 feet above the neighbor's house. It is tastefully black and unadorned, not a news crew, though another helicopter, an old-fashioned audible one, brightly festooned with up-to-the-minute logos, is thumping and whacking its way across White Column's airspace at this very moment, goosing the plantations with its own spotlight, hoping to be the first to obtain this major scoop. A pizza was delivered late tonight. Film at 11. Later, our personality journalist speculates on where Uncle Enzo will stay when he makes his compulsory trip to our standard metropolitan statistical area. But the black chopper is running dark, would be nearly invisible if not for the infrared trail coming out of its twin turbojets. It is a mafia chopper, and all they wanted to do was to record the event on videotape so that Mr. Pudgley would not have a leg to hop around on in court. Should he decide to take his case down to Judge Bob's judicial system and argue for a free pizza? One more thing. There's a lot of shit in the air tonight. A few megatons of topsoil blowing down from Fresno. And so when the laser beam comes on, it is startlingly visible. A tiny geometric line. A million blazing red grains strung on a fiber optic thread, snapping into life instantly between the chopper and YT's chest. It appears to widen into a narrow fan, an acute triangle of red light, whose base encompasses all of YT's torso. It takes half a second. They are scanning the many barcodes mounted on her chest. They are finding out who she is. The mafia now knows everything about YT, where she lives, what she does, her eye color, credit record, ancestry, and blood type. That done, the chopper tilts and vanishes into the night, like a hockey puck sliding into a bowl of India ink. Mr. Pudgley is saying something, making a joke about how close they came. The others eke out a laugh, but YT cannot hear them because they are buried under the thunder whack of the news chopper, then flash frozen and crystallized under its spotlight. The night air is full of bugs, and now YT can see all of them, swirling in mysterious formations, hitching rides on people and on currents of air. There is one on her wrist, but she doesn't slap at it. The spotlight lingers for a minute. The broad square of the pizza box bearing the Cosa Nostra logo is mute testimony. They hover, shoot a little tape, just in case. YT is bored. She gets on her plank. The wheels blossom and become circular. She guides a tight, wobbly course around the cars, coasts down into the street. The spotlight follows her for a moment, maybe picking up some stock footage. Videotape is cheap. You never know when something will be useful, so you might as well videotape it. People make their living that way. People in the intel business. People like Hero Protagonist. They just know stuff, or they just go around and videotape stuff. They put it in the library. When people want to know the particular things that they know or watch their videotapes, they pay them money and check it out of the library or just buy it outright. This is a weird racket, but YT likes the idea of it. Usually the CIC won't pay any attention to a courier. But apparently Hero has a deal with them. Maybe she can make a deal with Hero. Because YT knows a lot of interesting little things. One little thing she knows is that the Mafia owes her a favor. As Hero approaches the street, he sees two young couples, probably using their parents' computers for a double date in the metaverse, climbing down out of Port Zero, which is the local port of entry and monorail stop. He is not seeing real people, of course. This is all a part of the moving illustration drawn by his computer according to specifications coming down the fiber optic cable. The people are pieces of software called avatars. They are the audio-visual bodies that people use to communicate with each other in the metaverse. Hero's avatar is now on the street, too, and if the couples coming off the monorail look over in his direction, they can see him, just as he's seeing them. They could strike up a conversation, Hero in the You Store It in L.A., and the four teenagers probably on a couch in a suburb of Chicago, each with their own laptop. But they probably won't talk to each other any more than they would in reality. These are nice kids, and they don't want to talk to a solitary crossbreed with a slick custom avatar who's packing a couple of swords. Your avatar can look any way you want it to, up to the limitations of your equipment. If you're ugly, you can make your avatar beautiful. If you've just gotten out of bed, your avatar can still be wearing beautiful clothes and professionally applied makeup. You can look like a gorilla, or a dragon, or a giant talking penis in the metaverse. Spend 5 minutes walking down the street, and you will see all of these. Hero's avatar just looks like Hero, with the difference that no matter what Hero is wearing in reality, his avatar always wears a black leather kimono. Most hacker types don't go in for garish avatars because they know that it takes a lot more sophistication to render a realistic human face than a talking penis. Kind of the way people who really know clothing can appreciate the fine details that separate a cheap gray wool suit from an expensive hand-tailored gray wool suit. You can't just materialize anywhere in the metaverse like Captain Kirk beaming down from on high. This would be confusing and irritating to the people around you. It would break the metaphor. Materializing out of nowhere or vanishing back into reality is considered to be a private function best done in the confines of your own house. Most avatars nowadays are anatomically correct and naked as a babe when they are first created. So in any case, you have to make yourself decent before you emerge into the street. Unless you're something intrinsically indecent and you don't care. If you are some peon who does not own a house, for example, a person who is coming in from a public terminal, then you materialize in a port. There are 256 express ports on the street, evenly spaced around its circumference at intervals of 256 kilometers. Each of these intervals is further subdivided 256 times with local ports, spaced exactly 1 kilometer apart. Astute students of hacker semiotics will note the obsessive repetition of the number 256, which is 2 to the 8th power, and even that 8 looks pretty juicy, dripping with 2 to the 2nd additional 2s. The ports serve a function analogous to airports. This is where you drop into the metaverse from somewhere else. Once you have materialized in a port, you can walk down the street or hop on the monorail or whatever. The couples, coming off the monorail, can't afford to have custom avatars made and don't know how to write their own. They have to buy off-the-shelf avatars. One of the girls has a pretty nice one. It would be considered quite the fashion statement among the K-Tel set. Looks like she has bought the Avatar Construction Set, TM, and put together her own, customized model out of miscellaneous parts. It might even look something like its owner. Her date doesn't look half bad himself. The other girl is a Brandy. Her date is a Clint. Brandy and Clint are both popular off-the-shelf models. When white trash high school girls are going on a date in the metaverse, they invariably run down to the computer games section of the local Walmart and buy a copy of Brandy. The user can select 3 breast sizes: improbable, impossible, and ludicrous. Brandy has a limited repertoire of facial expressions. Cute and pouty, cute and sultry, perky and interested, smiling and receptive, cute and spacey. Her eyelashes are half an inch long, and the software is so cheap that they are rendered as solid ebony chips. When a Brandy flutters her eyelashes, you can almost feel the breeze. Clint is just the male counterpart of Brandy. He is craggy and handsome and has an extremely limited range of facial expressions. Hero wonders idly how these two couples got together. They are clearly from disparate social classes. Perhaps older and younger siblings. But then they come down the escalator and disappear into the crowd and become part of the street, where there are enough Clints and Brandys to found the new ethnic group. The street is fairly busy. Most of the people here are Americans and Asians. It's early morning in Europe right now. Because of the preponderance of Americans, the crowd has a garish and surreal look about it. For the Asians, it's the middle of the day, and they are in their dark blue suits. For the Americans, it's party time, and they are looking like just about anything a computer can render. The moment Hero steps across the line separating his neighborhood from the street, colored shapes begin to swoop down on him from all directions, like buzzards on fresh roadkill. Animercials are not allowed in Hero's neighborhood, but almost anything is allowed in the street. A passing fighter plane bursts into flames, falls out of its trajectory, and zooms directly toward him at twice the speed of sound. It plows into the street, 50 feet in front of him, disintegrates and explodes, blooming into a tangled cloud of wreckage and flame that skids across the pavement toward him, growing to envelop him so that all he can see is turbulent flame, perfectly simulated and rendered. Then the display freezes, and a man materializes in front of Hero. He is a classic bearded, pale, skinny hacker, trying to beef himself up by wearing a bulky silk windbreaker blazoned with the logo of one of the big metaverse amusement parks. Hero knows the guy. They used to run into each other at trade conventions all the time. He's been trying to hire Hero for the last 2 months.
"Hero, I can't understand why you're holding out on me. We're making bucks here. Kong bucks and yen, and we can be flexible on paying bennies. We're putting together a swords and sorcery thing, and we could use a hacker with your skills. Come on down and talk to me, okay?"
Hero walks straight through the display and it vanishes. Amusement parks in the metaverse can be fantastic, offering a wide selection of interactive, three-dimensional movies. But in the end, there's still nothing more than video games. Hero's not so poor yet that he would go and write video games for this company. It's owned by the Nipponese, which is no big deal. But it's also managed by the Nipponese, which means that all the programmers have to wear white shirts and show up at 8 in the morning and sit in cubicles and go to meetings. When Hero learned how to do this way back 15 years ago, a hacker could sit down and write an entire piece of software by himself. Now, that's no longer possible. Software comes out of factories, and hackers are, to a greater or lesser extent, assembly line workers. Worse yet, they may become managers who never get to write any code themselves. The prospect of becoming an assembly line worker gives Hero some incentive to go out and find some really good intel tonight. He tries to get himself psyched up, tries to break out of the lethargy of the long-term underemployed. This intel thing can be a great racket once you get yourself jacked into the grid. And with his connections, it shouldn't be any problem. He just has to get serious about it. Get serious. Get serious. But it's so hard to get serious about anything. He owes the mafia the cost of a new car. That's a good reason to get serious. He cuts straight across the street and under the monorail line, headed for a large, low-slung black building. It is extraordinarily somber for the street, like a parcel that someone forgot to develop. It's a squat black pyramid with the top cut off. It has one single door. Since this is all imaginary, there are no regulations dictating the number of emergency exits. There are no guards, no signs, nothing to bar people from going in, yet thousands of avatars mill around, peering inside, looking for a glimpse of something. These people can't pass through the door because they haven't been invited. Above the door is a matte black hemisphere about a meter in diameter, set into the front wall of the building. It is the closest thing the place has to decoration. Underneath it, in letters carved into the wall's black substance, is the name of the place, the Black Sun. So it's not an architectural masterpiece. When David and Hero and the other hackers wrote the Black Sun, they didn't have enough money to hire architects or designers, so they just went in for simple geometric shapes. The avatars milling around the entrance don't seem to care. If these avatars were real people in a real street, Hero wouldn't be able to reach the entrance. It's way too crowded. But the computer system that operates the street has better things to do than to monitor every single one of the millions of people there, trying to prevent them from running into each other. It doesn't bother trying to solve this incredibly difficult problem. On the street, avatars just walk right through each other. So when Hero cuts through the crowd headed for the entrance, he really is cutting through the crowd. When things get this jammed together, the computer simplifies things by drawing all of the avatars ghostly and translucent so you can see where you're going. Hero appears solid to himself, but everyone else looks like a ghost. He walks through the crowd as if it's a fog bank, clearly seeing the black sun in front of him. He steps over the property line and he's in the doorway. And in that instant, he becomes solid and visible to all the avatars milling outside. As one, they all begin screaming. Not that they have any idea who the hell he is. Hero is just a starving CIC stringer who lives in a youth store by the airport. But in the entire world, there are only a couple of thousand people who can step over the line into the black sun. He turns and looks back at 10,000 shrieking groupies. Now that he's all by himself in the entryway, no longer immersed in a flood of avatars, he can see all of the people in the front row of the crowd with perfect clarity. They are all done up in their wildest and fanciest avatars, hoping that David, the Black Sun's owner and hacker-in-chief, will invite them inside. They flicker and merge together into an hysterical wall. Stunningly beautiful women, computer airbrushed and retouched at 72 frames a second, like Playboy pinups turned three-dimensional. These are would-be actresses hoping to be discovered. Wild-looking abstracts, tornadoes of gyrating light, hackers who are hoping that David will notice their talent, invite them inside, give them a job. A liberal sprinkling of black-and-white people, persons who are accessing the metaverse through cheap public terminals and who are rendered in jerky, grainy black-and-white. A lot of these are run-of-the-mill psycho fans, devoted to the fantasy of stabbing some particular actress to death. They can't even get close in reality, so they goggle into the metaverse to stalk their prey. There are would-be rock stars done up in laser light as though they just stepped off the concert stage, and the avatars of Nipponese businessmen, exquisitely rendered by their fancy equipment, but utterly reserved and boring in their suits. There's one black and white who stands out because he's taller than the rest. The street protocol states that your avatar can't be any taller than you are. This is to prevent people from walking around a mile high. Besides, if this guy's using a pay terminal, which he must be to judge from the image quality, it can't jazz up his avatar. It just shows him the way he is, except not as well. Talking to a black and white on the street is like talking to a person who has his face stuck in a Xerox machine, repeatedly pounding the copy button, while you stand by the output tray pulling the sheets out one at a time and looking at them. He has long hair, parted in the middle like a curtain to reveal a tattoo on his forehead. Given the shitty resolution, there's no way to see the tattoo clearly, but it appears to consist of words. He has a wispy Fu Manchu mustache. Hero realizes that the guy has noticed him and is staring back, looking him up and down, paying particular attention to the swords. A grin spreads across the black and white guy's face. It is a satisfied grin, a grin of recognition, the grin of a man who knows something Hero doesn't. The black and white guy has been standing with his arms folded across his chest, like a man who is bored, who's been waiting for something, and now his arms drop to his sides, swing loosely at the shoulders, like an athlete limbering up. He steps as close as he can and leans forward. He's so tall that the only thing behind him is empty black sky, torn with the glowing vapor trails of passing animercials.
"Hey, Hiro," the black and white guy says. "You want to try some snow crash?"
A lot of people hang around in front of the black sun saying weird things. You ignore them. But this gets Hiro's attention. Oddity the First. The guy knows Hiro's name, but people have ways of getting that information. It's probably nothing. The second, this sounds like an offer from a drug pusher, which would be normal in front of a reality bar, but this is the metaverse, and you can't sell drugs in the metaverse because you can't get high by looking at something. The third, the name of the drug. Hiro's never heard of a drug called Snow Crash before. That's not unusual. 1,000 new drugs get invented each year, and each of them sells under 6 brand names. But Snow Crash is computer lingo. It means a system crash, a bug, at such a fundamental level that it frags the part of the computer that controls the electron beam in the monitor, making it spray wildly across the screen, turning the perfect gridwork of pixels into a gyrating blizzard. Hiro has seen it happen 1,000,000 times, but it's a very peculiar name for a drug. The thing that really gets Hiro's attention is his confidence. He has an utterly calm, stolid presence. It's like talking to an asteroid, which would be okay if he were doing something that made the tiniest little bit of sense. Hiro's trying to read some clues in the guy's face, but the closer he looks, the more his shitty black-and-white avatar seems to break up into jittering, hard-edged pixels. It's like putting his nose against the glass of a busted TV. It makes his teeth hurt.
"Excuse me," Hiro says. "What did you say?" "You want to try some snow crash?"
He has a crisp accent that Hiro can't quite place. His audio is as bad as his video. Hiro can hear cars going past the guy in the background. He must be goggled in from a public terminal alongside some freeway.
"I don't get this," Hiro says. "What is Snow Crash?" "It's a drug, asshole," the guy says. "What do you think?"
"Wait a minute. This is a new one on me," Hiro says. "You honestly think I'm going to give you some money here? And then what do? Wait for you to mail me the stuff?"
"I said try, not buy," the guy says. "You don't have to give me any money. Free sample. And you don't have to wait for no mail. You can have it now."
He reaches into his pocket and pulls out a hypercard. It looks like a business card. The hypercard is an avatar of sorts. It is used in the metaverse to represent a chunk of data. It might be text, audio, video, a still image, or any other information that can be represented digitally. Think of a baseball card which carries a picture, some text, and some numerical data. A baseball hypercard could contain a highlight film of the player in action, shown in perfect, high-def television, a complete biography read by the player himself in stereo digital sound, and a complete statistical database along with specialized software to help you look up the numbers you want. A hypercard can carry a virtually infinite amount of information. For all Hiro knows, this hypercard might contain all the books in the Library of Congress or every episode of Hawaii 5-0 that was ever filmed, or the complete recordings of Jimi Hendrix, or the 1950 census. Or, more likely, a wide variety of nasty computer viruses. If Hiro reaches out and takes the hypercard, then the data it represents will be transferred from this guy's system into Hiro's computer. Hiro, naturally, wouldn't touch it under any circumstances, any more than you would take a free syringe from a stranger in Times Square and jab it into your neck. And it doesn't make sense, anyway.
"That's a hypercard. I thought you said Snow Crash was a drug," Hiro says, now totally nonplussed. "It is," the guy says. "Try it." "Does it fuck up your brain?" Hiro says. "Or your computer?" "Both." "Neither. What's the difference?" Hero finally realizes that he has just wasted 60 seconds of his life having a meaningless conversation with a paranoid schizophrenic. He turns around and goes into the black sun. Six. At the exit of White Columns sits a black car curled up like a panther, a burnished steel lens reflecting the low glow of Oahu Road. It is a unit. It is a mobile unit of Medicops Unlimited. A silvery badge is embossed on its door. A chrome-plated cop badge the size of a dinner plate, bearing the name of said private peace organization and emblazoned, "Dial 1-800-THE-COPS, all major credit cards." Medicops Unlimited is the official peacekeeping force of White Columns, and also of the Muse at Windsor Heights, the Heights at Bear Run, Cinnamon Grove, and the Farms of Cloverdale. They also enforce traffic regulations on all highways and byways operated by Fairlanes, Inc. A few different FOQNEs also use them, Caymans Plus and the Alps, for example. But franchise nations prefer to have their own security force. You can bet that Medizania and New South Africa handle their own security. That's the only reason people become citizens, so they can get drafted. Obviously, Nova Sicilia has its own security, too. Narcolumbia doesn't need security because people are scared just to drive past the franchise at less than 100 miles an hour. YT always snags a nifty power boost in neighborhoods thick with Narcolumbia consulates. And Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong, the granddaddy of all FOQNEs, handles it in a typically Hong Kong way, with robots. Medicop's main competitor, Worldbeat Security, handles all roads belonging to cruiseways, plus has worldwide contracts with Dixie Traditionals, Pickett's Plantation, Rainbow Heights, check it out, two apartheid burbclaves, and one for black suits. Meadowvale on the insert name of river, and Brickyard Station. Worldbeat is smaller than Medicops, handles more upscale contracts, supposedly has a bigger espionage arm. Though, if that's what people want, they just talk to an account rep at the Central Intelligence Corporation. And then there's the enforcers. But they cost a lot and don't take well to supervision. It is rumored that, under their uniforms, they wear T-shirts bearing the unofficial enforcer coat of arms. A fist holding a nightstick emblazoned with the words, "Sue me." So YT is coasting down a gradual slope toward the heavy iron gate of White Columns, waiting for it to roll aside, waiting, waiting, but the gate does not seem to be opening. No laser pulse has shot out of the guard shack to find out who YT is. The system has been overridden. If YT was a stupid ped, she would go up to the Medicop and ask him why. The Medicop would say, "The security of the city-state," and nothing more. These burbclaves, these city-states, so small, so insecure that just about everything, like not mowing your lawn or playing your stereo too loud, becomes a national security issue. No way to skate around the fence. White Columns has 8-foot iron robo-rot all the way around. She rolls up to the gate, grabs the bars, rattles it, but it's too big and solid to rattle. Medicops aren't allowed to lean against their unit, makes them look lazy and weak. They can almost lean, look like they're leaning. They can even brandish a big leaning against the car too, like this particular individual, but they can't lean. Besides, with the complete glinting majesty of their personal portable equipment suite hanging on their personal modular equipment harness, they would scratch the finish of the unit. "Jack this barrier to commerce, man. I got deliveries to make," YT announces to the Medicop. A wet, smacking burst, not loud enough to be an explosion, sounds from the back of the mobile unit. It is the soft thump of a thick wrestler's loogie being propelled through a rolled-up tongue. It is the distant, muffled splurt of a baby having a big one. YT's hand, still gripping the bars of the gate, stings for a moment, then feels cold and hot at the same time. She can barely move it. She smells vinyl. The Medicop's partner climbs out of the back seat of the mobile unit. The window of the back door is open, but everything on the mobile unit is so black and shiny, you can't tell that until the door moves. Both Medicops, under their glossy black helmets and night vision goggles, are grinning. The one getting out of the mobile unit is carrying a short-range chemical restraint projector, a loogie gun. Their little plan has worked. YT didn't think to aim her night visions into the back seat to check for a goo-firing sniper. The loogie, when expanded into the air like this, is about the size of a football. Miles and miles of eensy but strong fibers like spaghetti. The sauce in the spaghetti is sticky, goopy stuff that stays fluid for an instant when the loogie gun is fired, then sets quickly. Medicops have to tote this kind of gear because when each franchulate is so small, you can't be chasing people around. The perp, almost always an innocent thrasher, is always a 3-second skateboard ride away from asylum in the neighboring franchulate. Also, the incredible bulk of the personal modular equipment harness, the chandeliero gear, and all that is clipped onto it slows them down so bad that whenever they try to run, people just start laughing at them. So instead of losing some pounds, they just clip more stuff onto their harnesses, like the loogie gun. The snotty fibrous drop of stuff has wrapped all the way around her hand and forearm and lashed them onto the bar of the gate. Excess goo has sagged and run down the bar a short ways, but is setting now, turning into rubber. A few loose strands have also whipped forward and gained footholds on her shoulder, chest, and lower face. She backs away, and the adhesive separates from the fibers, stretching out into long, infinitely thin strands, like hot mozzarella. These set instantly, become solid, and then break, curling away like smoke. It is not quite so gratendous, now that the loogie is off her face, but her hand is still perfectly immobilized.
You are hereby warned that any movement on your part not explicitly endorsed by verbal authorization on my part may pose a direct physical risk to you, as well as consequential psychological and possibly, depending on your personal belief system, spiritual risks ensuing from your personal reaction to said physical risk. Any movement on your part constitutes an implicit and irrevocable acceptance of such risk, the first medicop says. There's a little speaker on his belt, simultaneously translating all of this into Spanish and Japanese.
Or as we used to say, the other medicop says, freeze, sucker!
The untranslatable word resonates from the little speaker, pronounced
es sucker and saca, respectively.
We are authorized deputies of Medicops Unlimited. Under Section 24.5.2 of the White Columns Code, we are authorized to carry out the actions of a police force on this territory.
Such as hassling innocent thrashers, YT says.
The medicop turns off the translator.
By speaking English, you implicitly and irrevocably agree for all our future conversation to take place in the English language, he says.
You can't even rez with YT says, YT says.
You have been identified as an investigatory focus of a registered criminal event that is alleged to have taken place on another territory, namely, the Mews at Windsor Heights.
That's another country, man. This is White Columns.
Under provisions of the Mews at Windsor Heights Code, we are authorized to enforce law, national security concerns, and societal harmony on said territory also. A treaty between the Mews at Windsor Heights and White Columns authorizes us to place you in temporary custody until your status as an investigatory focus has been resolved.
Your ass is busted, the second medicop says.
As your demeanor has been non-aggressive, and you carry no visible weapons, we are not authorized to employ heroic measures to ensure your cooperation, the first medicop says.
You stay cool and we'll stay cool, the second medicop says.
However, we are equipped with devices included but not limited to projectile weapons, which, if used, may pose an extreme and immediate threat to your health and well-being.
Make one funny move and we'll blow your head off, the second medicop says.
Just unglom my fucking hand, YT says.
She has heard all this a million times before. White Columns, like most burbclaves, has no jail, no police station. So unsightly. Property values. Think of the liability exposure. Medicops is a franchise just down the road that serves as headquarters. As for a jail, some place to habeas the occasional stray corpus. Any half-decent franchise strip has one. They are cruising in the mobile unit. YT's hands are cuffed together in front of her. One hand is still half-encased in rubbery goo, smelling so intensely of vinyl fumes that both metacops have rolled down their windows. 6 feet of loose fibers trail into her lap, across the floor of the unit, out the door, and drag on the pavement. The metacops are taking it easy, cruising down the middle lane, not above issuing a speeding ticket here and there, as long as they're in their jurisdiction. Motorists around them drive slowly and sanely, appalled by the thought of having to pull over and listen to half an hour of disclaimers, advisements, and tangled justifications from the likes of these. The occasional Cosa Nostra delivery boy whips past them in the left lane, orange lights aflame, and they pretend not to notice.
"What's it gonna be, the Hooskow or the Clink?" the first metacop says.
From the way he is talking, he must be talking to the other metacop. "The Hooskow, please," YT says.
"The Clink,"
the other metacop says, turning around, sneering at her through the anti-ballistic glass, wallowing in power. The whole interior of the car lights up as they drive past a buy-and-fly. Loiter in the parking lot of a buy-and-fly, and you'd get a suntan. Then World Beat Security would come and arrest you. All that security-inducing light makes the Visa and MasterCard stickers in the driver's side window glow for a moment.
YT is card-carrying, YT says. "What does it cost to get off?"
"How come you keep calling yourself Whitey?"
the second metacop says. Like many people of color, he has misconstrued her name.
"Not Whitey, YT," the first metacop says.
"That's what YT is called," YT says.
"That's what I said," the second metacop says. "Whitey, YT," the first one says, accenting the T so brutally that he throws a glittering burst of saliva against the windshield. "Let me guess. Yolanda Truman? No. Yvonne Thomas? No. What's it stand for?"
"Nothing."
"Actually, it stands for yours truly, but if they can't figure that out, fuck 'em."
"You can't afford it," the first metacop says. "You're going up against TMAWH here."
"I don't have to officially get off. I could just escape."
"This is a class unit. We don't support escapes," the first metacop says.
"Tell you what," the second one says. "You pay us $1 trillion, and we'll take you to a Hooskow. Then you can bargain with them."
$500 billion, YT says.
$750 billion, the metacop says. "Final. Shit, you're wearing cuffs. You can't be bargaining with us."
YT unzips a pocket in the thigh of her coverall, pulls out the card with her clean hand, runs it through a slot on the back of the front seat, puts it back in her pocket. The Hooskow looks like a nice new one. YT has seen hotels that were worse places to sleep. Its logo sign, a saguaro cactus with a black cowboy hat resting on top of it at a jaunty angle, is brand new and clean.
"The Hooskow, premium incarceration and restraint services. We welcome busloads."
There are a couple of other metacop cars in the lot, and an enforcer patty bus parked across the back, taking up 10 consecutive spaces. This draws much attention from the metacops. The enforcers are to the metacops what the Delta Force is to the Peace Corps.
"One to check in," says the second metacop.
They are standing in the reception area. The walls are lined with illuminated signs, each one bearing the image of some Old West desperado. Annie Oakley stares down blankly at YT, providing a role model. The check-in counter is faux rustic. The employees all wear cowboy hats and five-pointed stars with their names embossed on them. In back is a door made of hokey old-fashioned iron bars. Once you got through there, it would look like an operating room. A whole line of little cells, curvy and white like prefab shower stalls. In fact, they double as shower stalls. You bathe in the middle of the room. Bright lights that turn themselves off at 11 o'clock. Coin-operated TV. Private phone line. YT can hardly wait. The cowboy behind the desk aims a scanner at YT, zaps her barcode. Hundreds of pages about YT's personal life zoom up on a graphic screen.
"Huh," he says, "female."
The two metacops look at each other like, "What a genius."
This guy could never be a medicop. Sorry, boys, we're full up. No space for females tonight.
Oh, come on!
See that bus in back? There was a riot at Snooze and Cruise. Some Narcolumbians were selling a bad batch of vertigo. Place went nuts. Enforcer sent in a half a dozen squads, brought in about 30. So we're full up. Try the clink down the street.
YT does not like the looks of this. They put her back in the car, turn on the noise cancellation in the back seat so she can't hear anything except squirts and gurgles coming from her own empty tummy, and the glistening crackle whenever she moves her glommed-up hand. She was really looking forward to a hoosegow meal. Campfire chili or bandit burgers. In the front seat, the two medicops are talking to each other. They pull out into traffic. Up in front of them is a square illuminated logo, a giant universal product code in black on white with Buy-N-Fly underneath it. Stuck onto the same signpost, beneath the Buy-N-Fly sign, is a smaller one, a narrow strip in generic lettering, the Clink. They are taking her to the Clink. The bastards. She pounds on the glass with cuffed together hands, leaving sticky handprints. Let these bastards try to wash the stuff off. They turn around and look right through her, the guilty scum, like they heard something but they can't imagine what. They enter the Buy-N-Fly's nimbus of radioactive blue security light. Second medicop goes in, talks to the guy behind the counter. There's a fat white boy purchasing a Monster Trucks magazine, wearing a new South Africa baseball cap with a Confederate flag, and overhearing them, he peers out the window, wanting to lay his eyes on a real perp. A second man comes out from back, same ethnicity as the guy behind the counter. Another dark man with burning eyes and a bony neck. This one is carrying a three-ring binder with the Buy-N-Fly logo. To find the manager of a franchise, don't strain to read his title off the name tag. Just look for the one with the binder. The manager talks to the medicop, nods his head, pulls a keychain out of a drawer. Second medicop comes out, saunters to the car, suddenly whips open the back door.
Shut up, he says, or next time I fire the loogie gun into your mouth.
Good thing you like the clink, YT says, because that is where you will be tomorrow night, loogie man.
Is that right?
Yeah, for credit card fraud.
Me cop, you thrasher. How you gonna make a case at Judge Bob's judicial system?
I work for Radic-KS. We protect our own.
Not tonight, you don't. Tonight you took a pizza from the scene of a car wreck. Left the scene of an accident. Radic-KS tell you to deliver that pizza?
YT does not return fire. The medicop is right. Radic-KS did not tell her to deliver that pizza. She was doing it on a whim.
So Radic-KS ain't gonna help you. So shut up.
He jerks her arm and the rest of her follows. The three-ringer gives her a quick look, just long enough to make sure she is really a person, not a sack of flour or an engine block or a tree stump. He leads them around to the fetid rump of the Buy-N-Fly, dark realm of wretched refuse and teeming dumpsters. He unlocks the back door, a boring steel number with jimmy marks around the edges like steel-clawed beasts have been trying to get in. YT is taken downstairs into the basement. First medicop follows, carrying her plank, banging it heedlessly against doorways and stained polycarbonate bottle racks.
Better take her uniform. All that gear, the second medicop suggests, not unlewdly.
The manager looks at YT, trying not to let his gaze travel sinfully up and down her body. For thousands of years, his people have survived on alertness, waiting for Mongols to come galloping over the horizon, waiting for repeat offenders to swing sawed-off shotguns across their checkout counters. His alertness right now is palpable and painful. He's like a goblet of hot nitroglycerin. The added question of sexual misconduct makes it even worse. To him, it's no joke. YT shrugs, trying to think of something unnerving and wacky. At this point, she's supposed to squeal and shrink, wriggle and whine, swoon and beg. They are threatening to take her clothes. How awful. But she does not get upset, because she knows that they are expecting her to. A courier has to establish space on the pavement.
Predictable law-abiding behavior lulls drivers. They mentally assign you to a little box in the lane, assume you will stay there, can't handle it when you leave that little box. YT is not fond of boxes. YT establishes her space on the pavement by zagging mightily from lane to lane, establishing a precedent of scary randomness, keeps people on their toes, makes them react to her, instead of the other way around. Now these men are trying to put her in a box, make her follow rules. She unzips her coverall all the way down below.